This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents Freak Kingdom, Hunter S. Thompson's manic 10-year crusade against American fascism. Written by Timothy Denevi, read by Mark Boyette. For Brett. I'm not at all embarrassed at the use of the word freak. I think the way things are going in this country today, it's a very honorable designation, and I'm proud of it. To be abnormal, to deviate from the style of government that I deplore in America today, is not only wise, but necessary. Hunter S. Thompson, Pitkin County Sheriff's Debate, October 24, 1970. Author's Note. The career of Hunter S. Thompson, in its bright arc across the second half of the previous century, continues to exist today in many forms, from his own prodigious output of personal narrative to a wealth of auxiliary materials such as interviews, films, and biographies. He has managed to pass an astonishing amount of his experience onto the printed page. As such, we've arrived at a point in the present where multiple versions of Hunter Thompson appear to coexist simultaneously. Versions that in his own writing he both encouraged and also fought back against, that have been amplified in the subsequent biographical works on his life and times, and that remain part of our popular culture, complicating our perspective on who, at different moments in his life, he might have actually been. The audiobook you're about to listen to is, among other things, an attempt to reevaluate Thompson's role as a political writer, as a literary journalist in the essayistic tradition whose activism remains underappreciated. To be sure, it constitutes one version among many, my own, a take that's been composed amid the very specific political climate we currently find ourselves inhabiting. To write this book, in addition to the years of research and interviews that went into its construction, I attended the 2016 political conventions in Cleveland and Philadelphia, and afterward reported on election night, the 2017 inauguration, and various protests in Washington, D.C. I'm only bringing up this series of events now to acknowledge the specific lens through which I've arranged everything you're about to hear. Which is to say, in writing about the past, I'm of course expressing in some manner my own concern for the current state of our institutions and ideals, for the Constitution, participatory democracy, and the independent press, that Hunter Thompson fought so tirelessly to defend. His perspective on the American Republic remains as valuable as ever. In this account, I've tried to dramatize his political evolution in the manner a novel might, while also citing every detail and quote along the way, with the hope of expressing, for you, the effort he put out as a writer and thinker to combat institutional injustice. In the end, his effort came at a dire personal cost. But during the period of time spanning John F. Kennedy's murder to Richard Nixon's resignation, it also set the real Hunter Thompson apart from the more outlandish versions we've come to identify with him. From the start, he understood better than most the possibilities and dangers inherent to the system of government that he liked to refer to as that fantastic possibility, the last, best hope of man. And whether you're already familiar with his fascinating career or happen to be coming to his story for the first time, I hope that you'll see in his perspective a timeless and necessary rigor, something worth considering every day, especially today. Chapter 1, The Valley of the Moon, 1963 to 1964. From the Emptiness of the Sky Itself. On an autumn afternoon in 1963, Hunter S. Thompson, a 26-year-old journalist living in a small rented cabin with his wife Sandy, was startled by a knock at the door. This was on Woody Creek Road, just outside of Aspen, Colorado. He and Sandy had been staying there since the end of the summer, a temporary arrangement. Thompson had recently been offered the position of West Coast correspondent for the National Observer, a weekly general interest newspaper owned by the Dow Jones Company, and the current plan was to save up enough money for a more permanent move to California. At the time, Sandy was 6 months pregnant. Thompson went to the door and opened it. Their neighbor, a rancher by the name of Wayne Wagner, was standing on the porch. Something was up. You could see it in the man's eyes, a pressing, expectant look. Wagner got right to the point. There'd been violence, he said, down in Dallas. John F. Kennedy had been shot. What's more, he was dead. Murdered. Thompson let out a sob. In the next moment, he started swearing. He swung his eyes at Wagner, briefly hoping that what he just heard might in fact be the setup to some outrageous punchline, but no. This pioneer family rancher wasn't the joking type. November 22, 1963. That afternoon, the information traveled the continent, occupying everything. A lament of incontestable volume. Thompson found out the way most people did, personally. Only later did you switch on the radio or television for confirmation. This much was clear. The head of the American government had been cut down by rifle fire in the broad Texas daylight. And the perpetrator, it was beginning to appear, came from the left of the political spectrum. A deranged communist with ties to Cuba and the Soviet Union, who'd coiled himself on the sixth floor of a nearby building to strike as if from everywhere at once, from above, from a sniper's distance, from the emptiness of the sky itself, his bullets shattering the famous young leader's body and head. Really, what had taken place was something more than an assassination. It amounted to both an act of terror and a violent regime change. The country would be under the command of Lyndon Baines Johnson, that ancient, lifelong politico whom Kennedy had sped past on his way to the nomination in 1960, and who would now be asked to stand in memoriam during the upcoming election cycle, with no guarantee of either continuity or victory. Hunter Thompson had become a Kennedy enthusiast 3 years earlier after watching the first televised presidential debate during a 1960 hitchhiking trip through California and the Pacific Northwest. With a friend, he'd caught a ride at the Oregon Turnpike to a small town bar, a place he must have known he'd never pass through again, where, on the television, he watched what he instantly understood to be the visual turning point in the battle between the country's conservative and liberal factions. JFK, while at times affected and calculating, had come to represent for Thompson and for many others the least terrible option American politics had seen in a generation, a leader who wouldn't be corrupted by the enormous degree of power he sought, and who, as a result, suggested a future in which the collective hopes of the country might for once outweigh the ruthless, cheap, small-minded, glaringly hypocritical ambition that so many other candidates had relied upon for victory. From Thompson's perspective, there'd been plenty to doubt in the 3 years since, but at least, with Kennedy, progress on civil rights and in international affairs seemed possible. For once, it felt as if the better sentiments of the American character had gotten a foot in the door. On that Friday afternoon in November, after Wagner delivered the terrible news and departed, Thompson grabbed his reporter's notebook and headed into town, where, as if from behind the lens of a camera, he began collecting first-hand testimony. He talked to everyone he could find. He copied out their reactions verbatim. People were shocked and scared and pessimistic for the future. They told him so. With pen and paper, he bore witness to the country's roaring pain. That night back at the cabin, as the radio reports gave way to a series of previously recorded Billy Graham sermons, he couldn't sleep. For a while, he worked on compiling the quotes he'd gathered, polishing them into a 1,000-word article he could then send to his editor at the National Observer. But eventually, he switched to a more intimate form of expression, personal letters. It is a triumph of lunacy, of rottenness, the dirtiest hour in our time. He wrote to Paul Semenin, an old friend from Louisville, "The shits were surely killing us, and now they have killed the only hope on the American horizon." He was afraid to fall asleep, he added, sure that he'd wake up to news of a full-scale attack on Cuba or some other communist satellite. It was as if the future itself could be redrawn in the blue silences of each new hour that passed. He finished the first letter and started another, and as the night gave way to morning, sunrise at 8,000 feet, a rarefied alpine light, he kept thinking about the long-term political ramifications of the assassination. For Thompson, Kennedy's murder was nothing short of a challenge to the soul of the Republic itself. America's duly elected leader had been removed from his post with violence. Such a thing had happened before, yes, but this current situation was altogether new. In an era of mutually assured nuclear destruction, it didn't necessarily matter if the assassin was a lone maniac or the agent of a wider plot. The result was the same. Power was being transferred across discrete, unmonitored channels. And the official narrative, emanating now like a deadly fog from the various outlets of the post-war media apparatus, suggested a familiar target: communists. In short, America had suffered an attack from the very threat its most conservative politicians had been shouting about as a means to advance their own careers for decades. "The political clock has been turned back to Eisenhower and McCarthy," he wrote. "It will almost surely mean a Goldwater victory in 64, a wild reaction against the Reds." Such a thing had seemed impossible only a few days earlier. But all of a sudden, Barry Goldwater, the conservative senator from Arizona, who in his campaign for the Republican nomination advocated a policy of more direct confrontation with the Soviet Union that could very quickly lead to nuclear war, appeared poised to embody the country's desire for retaliation, for vengeance. It would play out both at home and abroad, against domestic groups like the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, and in shows of force against weaker communist governments the military would be looking to make an example out of. And as he considered these ramifications, Thompson found himself hung up on a single word: shit rain. This was what he imagined, a deluge of human barbarity that would swirl and descend and dirty itself in endless succession. At last, the worst aspects of mankind were coming together to submerge the very best in us all. There was nowhere to hide, let alone run. The unique horror of Kennedy's death was that at the time, it appeared to offer the ideal catalyst for national suicide. In the aftermath of such an extreme event, how long would it be until constitutional rights were suspended, journalists were silenced, individual expression was criminalized, and in the name of safety and security, the last remnants of open political dissent were eradicated from the national stage? Thompson had already seen it happen elsewhere. The previous year, traveling up and down South America as a stringer for The Observer, he'd written extensively on the subject in articles with titles like "Democracy Dies in Peru, But Few Seem to Mourn Its Passing," and "It's a Dictatorship, But Few Seem to Care to Stay and Fight." Of late, he'd begun to believe that America was much more vulnerable to fascistic, populist, militaristic forces than most of its citizens cared to think. In this sense, Barry Goldwater wasn't the only homegrown threat on the horizon. During the long funeral week that followed the assassination, as the major news outlets provided unverified updates that felt indistinguishable from speculation, Thompson's thoughts turned to the prospects of another right-wing politician, a man who'd also relied on the previous decade's climate of communist fear-mongering to propel a national career. "And now," Thompson wrote later that week, "with a hairy animal called Nixon looming once again on the horizon, I am ready to believe that we are indeed in the time of the end." It was inconceivable. Only a year before, on November 7, 1962, Nixon had stood in front of reporters at the Biltmore Hotel in Los Angeles, and while ostensibly delivering a concession speech to mark the end of his failed bid for the California governorship, proceeded to openly reveal himself as the petulant, narcissistic hypocrite he'd always worked so gratuitously to hide. This speech lasted 15 minutes. Throughout it, he lamented how his opponent had treated him, how biased the press coverage had been, going so far as to single out certain reporters in particular, and how, in summary, everyone had conspired to give him what he referred to as the shaft. It was a spectacular meltdown. Here was a politician who'd previously painted himself, in often garish strokes, as the humblest of civil servants, acting solely out of love for God and country, and who, in a fit of victimhood and rage, was throwing a match to all of it. "You won't have Nixon to kick around anymore," he finally bleated, "because, gentlemen, this is my last press conference." But now, after the president's murder in Dallas at the hands of a maniac communist, all bets, including those on Nixon's future, were suddenly off. For Thompson, the very mention of the name Richard Nixon was itself a testament to the horrific ramifications of Kennedy's death. "There is no explanation for the durability of that man," he added. "He is like a hyena that you shoot and gut and then see a few hours later loping along in his stinking way, oblivious to the fact that he is not only dead but gutted as well." The 1964 Republican convention was only 9 months away. It would be held in San Francisco. And while Thompson had been working on a move from Colorado to California for a while, the assassination clarified the matter. The political climate was in flux. And as a West Coast journalist based in the Bay Area, he figured he'd be able to best participate in the fight that was to come. It would be an ugly, unprecedented battle, but he needed to do something. It was up to him to get closer to the action. "I don't mind saying that my primary motive," he explained, "is to keep that man Nixon out of the presidency." The tragedy provided Thompson a fresh burst of determination. For the past half decade, he'd been trying to break through as a journalist and also as a fiction writer. And by 26, he'd already written 2 unpublished novels while steadily climbing the ranks as a freelancer. But neither had paid off. He knew it was finally time to make a decision. So on that tragic, long-ago Friday in November, as news reports on the radio confirmed the president's assassination and not much else, he wrote in a letter to the novelist William Kennedy, his close friend, "Fiction is dead." Instead, from here on out, he vowed to devote himself to journalism, his own way of influencing, however subtly, the political and cultural direction in which the country might go. "The stakes are now too high," he added, "and the time too short." In the same letter, he offered a personal articulation of the tragedy. "There is no human being within 500 miles to whom I can communicate anything," he wrote, "much less the fear and loathing that is on me after today's murder. Fear for America's core democratic values, for the safety of his family in a society that appeared to be going mad, and loathing for the power-hungry figures who were willing to sacrifice the basic tenets on which the Republic was founded." Looking back, this appears to mark his first recorded usage of that short phrase he'd make famous. It's a striking description of the tragedy's true shape, the absence that the murder had created in millions of individual American hearts and in the collective heart of the nation as well, a grave blow to everything the country hadn't yet become, but still someday might. What happens when an idealistic young leader is replaced by a sense of bottomless distress, forged from equal parts terror and hatred? Into the emptiness of this new space, anything might flow. Doom, fate, the future, or maybe Richard Milhouse Nixon. Something, at any rate, was coming, and Hunter Thompson planned to be there when it finally emerged. The least he could do was document its progress. Sunrise in Sonoma. The Thompsons moved to California 3 months after John F. Kennedy's assassination. They'd hoped to leave before that, but there'd been lingering financial questions, and by the time they secured the money for a down payment and headed west, hauling a trailer across 1,200 miles of dirty snow, it was the middle of winter, February 1964. They made the trip in a 1959 Rambler Custom, a cream-colored sedan with brown piping and bench seats, a wedding present from Sandy's mother. Agar, their purebred Doberman, rode along with them. Sandy was 8 months pregnant. Their designation was a small town 50 miles north of San Francisco, Glen Ellen, located in the Sonoma Valley. They'd been married for less than a year. In retrospect, their relationship at the time seemed, for all intents and purposes, healthy. They were young and intimate, and together they'd found a path to create a life they could both share. Sandy had just turned 26. She had dark eyebrows and striking hazel eyes. Her hair was long and blonde, parted down the middle. She'd been born in New York and attended Goucher College, an all-girls university in Baltimore known then for its conservative curriculum. They'd first met in 1958, on Christopher Street in Greenwich Village during the Thanksgiving holiday. At the time, she was engaged to someone else. And in the years since, they'd lived together in places like San Juan and Big Sur and Rio de Janeiro and Louisville. Now, in the winter of 1964, arriving in Glen Ellen with a baby on the way, they'd arranged to rent a roomy cottage just down the road from Jack London State Park. But when they finally crossed California and pulled into this secluded valley north of the state's famous bay, they were told, much to their disbelief, that there'd been a misunderstanding. The cottage they were to live in had, in fact, been promised to someone else. Suddenly, they had nowhere to go. The only other option was a small tin-walled structure at the top of the main property, what was, for all intents and purposes, a hillside shack. But they had no choice but to accept. It could have been worse. This shack consisted of two rooms, one large and one small, along with a kitchen, and it had running water and electricity. The mattress was set up on box springs. At night, Agar slept in the bed between them. To prepare for the baby, they purchased what furniture they could afford from the local thrift shop. In the winter, the valley was a vast, windless depression of intermittent sunlight, the mountains holding the fog from the coast. The Valley of the Moon, Jack London had called it. Only a few of the roads were paved. The fields smelled like manure. Many of their neighbors were former Oklahomans, transplants from the Dust Bowl, a conservative population that tended to view a professional occupation like Thompson's, writer, with suspicion. Sandy's water broke early on a morning in March. By the time they made it to the hospital in Santa Rosa, the baby was ready. "You could have given birth in a field," the doctor said afterward. It was a boy. They named him Juan Fitzgerald, for the fallen president whose murder continued to shadow the present, and also for F. Scott, the author of The Great Gatsby, which was one of Thompson's favorite books. Suddenly, they were a family. Three humans and a bed-sleeping dog, all of them residing in the tin-walled shack. Shortly after the delivery, Juan had suffered a health scare. There had been a complication regarding blood types, but now he was gaining weight. At night, he fell asleep to the sound of Hunter Thompson's typewriter. Years later, Sandy would reflect on these first months in Sonoma as some of the very best in her life. She was surrounded by everything in the world she loved most. It was a period of stillness and safety, the future stretching outward with the same startling clarity that marked the present. But for Hunter Thompson, it was the opposite. The move to California was quickly evolving into one of the great crises of his young life. In the wake of Kennedy's death, all he could focus on were the things he hadn't yet accomplished. Everywhere he looked, he saw impediments, signs that revealed his coming failure. He didn't have enough time or money or support to become the writer he'd spent his adult life fashioning himself into. The editors at the National Observer may have given him a lofty title, but they still paid him no salary, only a fee for each article. What's more, they kept rejecting his pitches. He wasn't allowed to write about the free speech movement in Berkeley, which he perceived, correctly in retrospect, as a vibrant indicator of the upheaval to come. 3 times a week, he drove to the Dow Jones office in San Francisco and was shocked by the incurious nature of his colleagues. It didn't seem to matter that he was married to a beautiful woman who loved him, that they'd had a child, a son, that by moving to Sonoma, he was acting on a moral imperative, living a life he felt called to answer, or that at last he was supporting himself and his family as a writer. I am deep in the grip of a professional collapse that worries me to the extent that I cannot do any work to cure it, he wrote in an April 7 letter. A failure of concentration, as it were, and a consequent plunge into debt and depression. A week later, he was considering moving his young family to Los Angeles or New York, or even Mexico City, anywhere to escape the deep, ugly funk he found himself in. When, on a weekday afternoon, Sandy was walking with Juan through Sonoma's large central square, when she happened to cross paths with a woman and her infant daughter. The woman's name was Terry Geiger. She lived nearby in a condo complex that, due to a remodeling project, was currently unoccupied. Together they started talking, and as the sun descended behind the western mountains and evening came on, as they began to realize just how much they appeared to have in common, Terry went so far as to make a spontaneous offer. What did Sandy think about bringing her family by that night for dinner? A few hours later, the Thompsons arrived at the condo complex in their Rambler. They were greeted by Terry's husband, Dr. Robert C. Geiger, a 33-year-old orthopedist who'd recently opened his first family practice in Sonoma, no small feat, and who also just that week had published his debut novel, Ask For Me Tomorrow, about a Californian surgeon preparing to ship out to South Vietnam. Bob Geiger had been told that their guests that night included a young journalist, but he had no idea what to expect. And as Hunter Thompson emerged from the driver's side, tall and long-limbed, his jaw sharp, his elbows bent, a jetty of hair receding above the broad, high slope of his forehead, Geiger was struck by an additional detail. Thompson exited the car slowly, a tiptoed step. He swung himself forward on his left foot, his hip revolving, a barely perceptible movement that a man of Geiger's training could tell after only a few strides was the result of uneven legs, the left one nearly half an inch shorter than the right. The two families gathered inside. After a few preliminary drinks, the conversation began. And as if on cue, Bob Geiger and Hunter Thompson began discussing politics and sports and writing. Both young men had qualities the other envied. Thompson was younger and had traveled all through South America, where he'd reported on government abuses and student demonstrations for a national periodical. He was making a living as a writer, if barely. He was politically savvy. Geiger, besides his medical and novelistic feats, also happened to be an amazing athlete, a college quarterback at Berkeley, and for the semi-professional Cal Ramblers. But their first interaction wasn't colored by envy. Instead, Geiger and Thompson stayed up together until the sun rose, long after Sandy and Juan had fallen asleep in the guest bedroom. The next morning, they were still talking and drinking, even as the sky above the Valley of the Moon brightened and lifted, a valley that on certain mornings could feel as isolated as its namesake and no less beautiful, especially when the dawn struck the shadows from the mountains and the day shaped itself forward, California emerging again as if from the ocean beyond. After their first dinner together, as spring gave way to the dry season, the Thompsons and the Geigers found themselves spending much of their time in each other's company. For Sandy, this new friendship was like a ballast, Now, when her husband traveled on assignment for the National Observer, she had people looking out for her and Juan, and a friend in Terry. And for Hunter Thompson, Bob Geiger provided a fresh, careful perspective on the world around them. Throughout April and May, they'd often head over to the nearby high school in the afternoon, where they'd throw the football around, or they might drive to the coast with Agar. At night, there were family dinners, a chance to extend their ongoing conversation. They talked about political activism, about what they could do personally to make a difference. And for a while, they genuinely considered making a trip down to Mississippi to register voters with the Freedom Riders. They also discussed the upcoming presidential contest and the differences between fiction and reporting, how Thompson might use the skills he developed as a novelist to liven up his articles, which would remain true in the sense that they accurately represented his interpretation of what had happened. Impressionistic journalism. This was the term Thompson had begun using to describe the hybridized, dramatized nature of his writing. They both liked to drink, especially together. For nearly a decade, ever since he was in high school, Thompson had been a functioning alcoholic. At the age of 26, he was still young enough to recover the next day, both physically and mentally. But the long nights of bourbon and beer inevitably took a toll. It didn't help that his writing schedule lacked structure. He liked to work late at night, often until daybreak, all the while drinking steadily. A balance that at certain points in the past he'd managed to pull off surprisingly well. But in Sonoma, in the wake of such a stressful move, not to mention the arrival of his first child, as well as the budding editorial disagreement with the National Observer, he found himself writing sparingly, sleeping poorly, and drinking even more than usual. The terrifying inspiration of Kennedy's murder was beginning to abate. Instead, he found himself waiting in a state of uncertainty and dread for the advent of the societal upheaval he'd been sure the assassination would precipitate. Dr. Bob Geiger, for his part, seemed to possess a preternatural capacity for time management. Each morning, he started things off with a 5-mile run, no matter the circumstances. Afterward, he'd head to his orthopedic practice or to Santa Rosa Hospital for surgery. When he wasn't on call, he'd match Thompson drink for drink, going entire nights without sleep, only to repeat his usual schedule the next day. He also wrote fiction, spent evenings with his family, played rugby for the Olympic Club in San Francisco, and found an hour or two each afternoon to throw the football around with his younger friend. It was a contrast so stark, they both couldn't help but notice. And that May, Dr. Bob Geiger broached the topic with Thompson. He had an idea, something he thought might help. Had Hunter Thompson ever considered Dexedrine? In 1964, this drug, a trade version of the psychostimulant amphetamine, wasn't yet regulated as a controlled substance. Thompson had tried stimulants before, experimenting with them a year earlier during his reporting trip to South America, but he'd never taken them regularly. What's more, a drug with dexedrine's properties, mixed with salt and consumed in tablets, tended to have a much smoother action than uppers like cocaine or benzedrine. Geiger had been taking dexedrine since medical school. Many of his colleagues used it regularly as a secret weapon to make it through the insane schedule their profession demanded. To him, it was a safer alternative to the most popular stimulant of all, tobacco, which each year was responsible for the deaths of many thousand Americans. He understood that the drug was really a performance sustainer, a way for talented but presently overwhelmed individuals to bridge the gap between ambition and productivity. It had a tendency of mimicking sobriety. With dexedrine, reality became less blurry and closer in proximity. All of a sudden, you could differentiate among your demands and complete the most immediate task without freaking out. In this sense, the distance between you and what you wanted to accomplish was thinned of interference, which went a long way toward offsetting whatever larger issues of motivation you might be facing. You could stay engaged with the object of your focus for longer stretches. After their discussion, Geiger wrote out a Dexedrine prescription for his new friend. And over the course of the next 10 years, Thompson would consume this drug daily, just as he did alcohol. But we're getting ahead of ourselves. At the time, there were immediate concerns. In fact, the start of his Dexedrine usage coincided with a long-standing obligation, his first major reporting trip since moving west, a 3-week, all-expenses-paid tour of Idaho, Montana, Wyoming, and the Badlands of North Dakota, during which he'd be expected to produce multiple pieces for the National Observer. His editors envisioned these articles as more sanitized versions of the dispatches he'd filed from South America the year before. They wanted him to avoid expressing his personal opinions or providing political context. And for the most part, he obliged them, at least on the surface. He completed 4 articles during the trip, 3 of which would be best categorized as travel logs. But the other, What Lured Hemingway to Ketchum, would push much deeper, personally and culturally, to defy the sort of easy classification his editors expected. Ernest Hemingway had killed himself in Ketchum, Idaho, 3 years earlier, and Thompson arrived there with the ostensible goal of answering the question posed in the headline. But his eventual article touched on a broader theme, one that had been haunting him ever since Kennedy's assassination. Like many another writer, Thompson wrote, Hemingway did his best work when he felt he was standing on something solid, like an Idaho mountainside or a sense of conviction. But what happens when the premise on which these convictions are based changes too rapidly and unpredictably? How do writers whose perspectives have been forged by their experiences within a certain time and place adjust to a new reality? To the mean nature of the world that will not stand still long enough for them to see it clear as a whole. In other words, how do you stay relevant when the moment in history you're tasked with rendering is defined by a lack of clarity? It is not just a writer's crisis, Thompson concluded. But they are the most obvious victims, because the function of art is supposedly to bring order out of chaos, a tall order even when the chaos is static, and a superhuman task in a time when chaos is multiplying. He finished the article with a haunting reference to Hemingway's suicide by shotgun at the age of 61, a decision, Thompson implied, that represented a final act of agency in the face of irrelevance and deterioration. After decades of hard living, Hemingway's body and mind had broken down. In the end, his perspective on the world, that lens through which he'd so famously articulated the major events of the century, had grown too outdated and simplistic for the complex moral realities of the early 1960s. Hemingway's suicide amounted to the saddest of epigraphs. What does it mean when the only thing you have left to express is a desire to take away your ability to say anything at all? At one point during his trip to Ketchum, Thompson was offered the chance to tour Ernest Hemingway's house. Afterward, after making his way through all the things Hemingway left behind, the detritus of this famous writer's late life and suicide, he noticed, hanging over the entrance, the bleached, perforated skull of a 10-point elk, its antlers standing against the wall like an ancient crown. In the next moment, he removed this trophy, carried it to the Rambler, and without anyone seeing, stashed it safely away. Richard Nixon, Barry Goldwater, and the Deep Revolutions of the Soul. That July, Hunter Thompson drove down from Sonoma to San Francisco to attend his first major political event, the 28th Republican National Convention. It was summer. Dusk. Above the bay, the hills rose like surf, lantern lit, as dense and cool as bottomless water. Downtown, the newest buildings crowded Union Square. On O'Farrell Street stood the 20-story Hilton, opened only 6 weeks earlier. Across the harbor, the ships were arriving. The sky was the same drained-out color of the bay, the ocean broken by wind. a city of Victorian mansions and mid-century skyscrapers, freeways and cable cars, and fleet, famous bridges. Tuesday, July 14, 1964. Already the convention was in its second day, the evening schedule of speeches about to kick off. In anticipation, Hunter Thompson situated himself in the single-level bowl of the stands, the gallery section, high above the floor and the delegates there. Through the National Observer, he'd been allotted one of the 5,423 press credentials. Around him, the Goldwater supporters numbered in the many thousands. They'd come to celebrate their candidate's nomination. Most of the attendees were staying on Nob Hill, but the events were being held 6 miles to the south at the Cow Palace, a 10,000-seat, hangar-shaped arena located along San Francisco's border with Daly City. The Cow Palace had been constructed 25 years earlier during the Works Progress era building boom to hold national livestock conventions. It had hosted everything from circuses to welterweight title fights. For the convention, the speaker's stand had been erected at the southern end atop a wood-paneled facade, behind which an enormous banner read, "By the People, of the People, for the People," a penny-shaped profile of Abraham Lincoln emblazoned alongside. The first major speech of the evening was from Dwight Eisenhower. "I'm here with great pride because I am a Republican," the old general said. For Thompson, Ike was a lot like Hemingway. He'd been built to win the battles we were no longer interested in fighting, a relic in the truest sense. The narrative on which he defined himself had been relegated, through no fault of his own, to another era. "My deep dedication to republicanism," he said. 2 months earlier, he had tried, along with other moderate conservatives, to steer the party away from the impending nomination of Barry Goldwater, and the majority of the crowd, made up of attendees far more radical than the old general would ever be, hadn't forgotten. It was an amazing sight. There at the podium, the great symbol of the American 1950s, of its conformity, its communist-baiting hysteria, its prosperity, had suddenly been transformed into irrelevance. What's more, this transformation had been initiated by none other than Goldwater, the silver-haired senator from Arizona, a man in his 50s who in his black horn-rimmed glasses looked more like the wealthy owner of a petroleum company than an agent for political change. Goldwater had arrived in San Francisco ready to reiterate his answer to the question that in the wake of Kennedy's murder would dominate the 1964 presidential election. How much risk is the United States willing to stomach, domestically and abroad? He'd won the nomination by running hard to the right. He voted no on the Civil Rights Act, despite his previous opposition to segregation. Railed against big government, refused to denounce the John Birch Society. His foreign policy positions had become increasingly extreme, effectively channeling the desire for vengeance in the wake of Kennedy's death. He threatened to invade Cuba, called for an open confrontation with communism, and advocated on multiple occasions, as a means to achieve their unconditional surrender, the right to launch a first-strike nuclear attack against the Soviet Union and its allies. In the eyes of his fervent supporters, he seemed to genuinely believe that to save the country you had to be willing to risk its destruction, and not by the means John Kennedy had employed during that famous October fortnight only 2 years earlier with his bluffs and blockades. For Goldwater, the battle was a matter of will. It could only be won by convincing your enemy of your ability to accept the unacceptable, a willingness to inflict death on a nuclear scale, and also absorb its unending consequences across all strata of society. Unlike most populist leaders, Goldwater did not promise a return to an idealized past. What he offered instead was the transformation into something altogether new, an American resurrection. Like a minor desert prophet, he burned coldly, and to his supporters in San Francisco, the extremes of their present day, assassinations and missile crises and racial unrest, only confirmed what they'd heard him saying all along: liberty with fire. That night, Eisenhower's speech was followed by one last challenge to Goldwater's nomination, a procedural move to revise the convention platform with amendments that, one, supported civil rights, two, disavowed the John Birch Society, and three, clarified the chain of command on the use of nuclear weapons. It was a gesture more than anything else. The math had been clear since the weekend, and despite a late challenge in the form of a poorly worded letter by Pennsylvania Governor William W. Scranton, no amount of debate, however spirited, would sway the current totals. But the intended audience for this final volley wasn't so much the Republicans at the Cow Palace as the many more watching on television. Not that the crowd saw it this way. From the start, they appeared incensed. And as multiple moderates from the East Coast establishment took the floor to denounce the extremism of their inevitable nominee, the chorus of displeasure rose, until during a late-night speech by Nelson D. Rockefeller, Goldwater's main primary opponent, the governor of New York, and for the last few years the most easily identified representative of the party's mainstream, a full-blown commotion broke out. Hunter Thompson was still in the stands, up among the Goldwater supporters, when it happened. Rockefeller was announced, allotted 5 minutes to speak on the amendments, but before he could say a word, the Cow Palace erupted. "We want Barry! We want Barry!" they shouted. They booed and howled. Like geese, they were hissing wildly. It was an arena-wide outburst, buttressed with innumerable noisemakers, horns, klaxons, bells, and trumpets, all of them ringing together. From somewhere distant came the martial bang of a drum. Rockefeller tried to speak, got drowned out, started again. Behind his heavy glasses, he seemed to be smirking. His jaw was clenched. His eyes were set in an ancient, aristocratic weariness, as if, with just a look, he could offer a gesture of such unparalleled disappointment the whole world would be bound to feel it. "We repudiate the efforts of irresponsible, extremist groups," he intoned, "such as the Communists, the Ku Klux Klan, the John Birch Society, and others." The thousands howling refused to let up. In them, Rockefeller saw a dangerous and cavalier disregard, and by the way he raised his chin, you could tell he hated them for it. Of course, they hated him right back. They were having fun. Together, they'd become overjoyed by the fact that he'd been forced up there on that speaker's platform to listen. "Our sole concern is for the future well-being of America," he said. And, "There is no place in the Republican Party for such hawkers of hate, such purveyors of prejudice." And, "The Republican Party must repudiate these people." In all, he was interrupted 22 times. When an organizer reminded him that his time was almost up, he shot back, "You control the audience, and I'll make my 5 minutes." But beneath the weight of their raucous human music, he'd been silenced. "This is still a free country," he finally muttered. At last, Thompson was witnessing, firsthand, the tumult he'd been sure of ever since Kennedy's death. The Goldwater supporters kept screeching, their horns and cowbells ringing louder than ever, even as the delegates on the floor were ordered to be quiet. Like cheap plastic, the arena vibrated. Still, the convention was only halfway done. Now that such a sound had come into being, it couldn't be unmade. The Cow Palace displaced any possibility of its absence. Instead, the great hangar-shaped dome of banners and blue smoke had become a portal, something into which this new expression, blaring at the same pitch of the previous year's national lament, passed fully into being. Throughout the convention, Thompson's assignment for the National Observer was simple. They wanted him to work as a stringer, gathering reactions and quotes that his editors, who would be writing the stories, could then include in their standard who, what, where, when, why recaps. In a role like this, access is key. And after finding himself confined for the most part to the gallery section during the first 2 days, he decided to take the matter into his own hands. It happened that a friend of his at the time, T. Floyd Smith, was working for the Pinkerton Agency, a private firm the Republicans hired to provide security. Smith had a badge that granted complete access, and when Thompson explained his desire to get closer to the action, he shrugged and said, "Take my credentials, I can go anywhere I want." Suddenly, for Hunter Thompson, the entire arena, a labyrinthine facility of obscure tunnels and observation decks and innumerable small rooms smelling like cigars and vodka and dour, sweaty men, was open. Throughout Wednesday and early Thursday, he roamed the grounds as if to map them out. Around each new corner there existed the promise of another enthralling glimpse into the nation's political mechanics, that process through which we provide a single American with the power to instantly end all our lives. He found himself in numerous caucus rooms that would have otherwise been off limits to the press, control centers for the Goldwater campaign, and for politicians like Maine Senator Margaret Chase Smith, the first woman to be put up for nomination for president at a Republican or Democratic convention. At VIP outposts for corporations and lobbyists, he ate and drank all he wanted for free. Of course, he dressed for the part in the sort of sport coat you'd find on a young congressional aide. He was clean-shaven, wearing wingtips. Still, he was uncomfortable trying to fit in. At one point, he made his way to the very top of the Cow Palace, where skyboxes had been constructed to accommodate members of the television networks. It was from these precipitous sets that the notable anchors, Chet Huntley and David Brinkley at NBC, Walter Cronkite at CBS, hosted their nightly shows. For Thompson, the contrast was astonishing. Huntley and Brinkley relied on an enormous staff of editors and experts to select the stories they hoped their audience would find the most interesting, while Walter Cronkite, suspended like an old philosopher king in his perch high above the arena, did all that work himself. For hours, he turned his attention to a chorus of closed-circuit television monitors, contemplating the convention from a dizzying degree of physical and perceptual distance. Thompson stayed up all night Wednesday in San Francisco, returning to the Cow Palace early Thursday afternoon for what would be the convention's main event. By this point, he'd been taking Dexedrine regularly for 2 months. Already, it appeared to be helping professionally. Amphetamine, in its effects, allowed him to stay awake longer than everyone else, with energy and focus, a supplement to the convention's frenetic environment. Suddenly, he could work harder than he had before, even as normal regulators like exhaustion and hunger blared terribly. He could drink with important people and remain more functionally sober than all of them. He could explore every inch of the 1964 Republican National Convention with such cartographical thoroughness that it was as if his goal all along had been to record its exact shape for a generation of people he knew he'd never meet. That Thursday evening, Barry Goldwater was scheduled to close out the festivities with his highly anticipated acceptance speech. What's more, he'd be introduced by none other than the former Vice President of the United States, Richard Milhouse Nixon, who'd returned from a short stint in the wilderness to put on his best face at this already contentious convention. Thompson was down on the floor among the 1,308 delegates when Nixon emerged. It was the first time the two of them had been in the same room together, only a few dozen feet apart. In 1964, Richard Nixon looked like a branch-level bank president who very much enjoyed telling people that they'd failed to qualify for a loan. He was 51 years old. From his speaker's perch on the Cow Palace floor, he gripped the podium tightly. His hair was oily and black, receding behind an evenly balanced widow's peak. He was wearing a slim navy tie to match his suit. His shirt was powder blue. His eyes flashed intelligently between the delegates below and the many thousands in the bleachers beyond. He was, and this can't be overstated, perfectly at ease, playing his favorite role of all, that of a humble, self-sacrificing idealist. "Now I'm just a simple soldier in the ranks," he said, smiling. Thompson knew the act. It was the same hokey shtick that Nixon had been using for years, most notably during his 1952 Checkers speech. "I'm just the hard-working son of a poor butcher," he liked to imply. A diligent, self-effacing Californian Quaker. The exact opposite of those East Coast Rockefeller elites. The audience ate it up. For Thompson, it had to be uncanny. To watch Richard Nixon live for the first time was to witness his one true talent, the ability to convince people who knew he was lying that they should trust him anyway. It's what made him such a resilient candidate. He could position himself for a future run by claiming to desire the exact opposite. He concluded his speech by gesturing theatrically. "Down this corridor will walk a man into the pages of history," he said. "He is the man who earned and proudly carries the title of Mr. Conservative, and he is the man who, after the greatest campaign in history, will be Mr. President, Barry Goldwater." And at that moment, as the silver-haired senator from Arizona strode forth to accept his party's nomination, as the band struck up Glory, Glory, Hallelujah, and the balloons came cascading down, thousands of them, many exploding loudly upon contact with the burning tips of equally numerous cigarettes, these two very different political animals basked at the podium together, hand in hand. "I'd like to thank my good friend Dick Nixon," Goldwater said. He slid on his bulky reading glasses, and for the next 40 minutes, in a calm, deliberate tone, he proceeded to enumerate the specifics of an ideology that, to Thompson, bordered on the apocalyptic. The speech was heavy on terms like liberty and law and order and security that alluded to his most controversial positions without stating them directly. Halfway through, he seemed to throw a jab in Nixon's direction. "Small men," he said, "seeking great wealth and power, have too often and too long turned even the highest levels of public service into mere personal opportunity." But the real surprise came just as his speech appeared to be winding down. Goldwater, after a brief silence, glanced at the podium, his jaw jutting sharply. Then, gazing out at the delegates below, he said, pausing every couple of words, "I would remind you that extremism, in defense of liberty, is no vice." In the next instant, the Cow Palace erupted. Shouts, whistles, applause, cheers, also the horns and drums. At first, it seemed to be the same sound as before, but after a few seconds, Thompson noticed a new component. All around him, the delegates were jostling, writhing. They banged their bodies against their chairs against the floor. And now the floor was rumbling against their countless stomping feet. Goldwater paused to let them have at it. "Thank you. Thank you," he mouthed at the microphone. He waved. Still, the sound kept rising. Thompson felt terrified. There was no mistaking it. The delegates around him were screaming and pounding violently, and amid them, he was the only person not doing the same. How long until they turned their fervor in his direction, and what happened then? Finally, Goldwater resumed. He offered a companion line. "Moderation in pursuit of justice is no virtue." And as the crowd echoed and reverberated and subsided, he finished his acceptance speech for the Republican nomination and with it this bewildering national convention. Afterward, exhausted and frightened, Thompson left the Cow Palace along with the thousands of other attendees, and skirting the civil rights protesters who'd been camped out in the parking lot for days, he crossed the 6 miles back to downtown San Francisco. His Dexedrine usage had caught up with him. He'd pushed too hard for too long. Soon enough, the crash would come. Already, he descended into a state of such exhaustion, he'd be given a reprimand the next day from his editors at The Observer. Still, the atavism of that moment on the floor, Goldwater's claim, and the thunder that erupted, its sinister appeal, would haunt him. 4 months later, he'd write in a letter to a friend, "I recall standing on the floor of the convention when G.W. made his acceptance speech and actually feeling afraid because I was the only person not clapping and shouting. And I was thinking, God damn you Nazi bastards, I really hope you win it. Because letting your kind of human garbage flood the system is about the only way to really clean it out." In retrospect, he couldn't have asked for a more poignant contrast of political identities, especially in the wake of Kennedy's assassination. With Barry Goldwater, you knew what you were going up against, a true believer. When he suggested that to save the country you had to be willing to risk its destruction, you immediately understood that he was speaking with a sort of compassion, however demented. With every bone in his body, he seemed to say, "If it's liberty through fire you're looking for, then rest assured, I will be the first to burn." A sentiment you can't fake. And the delegates that night, hearing it distilled in the line about extremism, had responded with their collective version of the same profound sincerity. Someone like Goldwater might have been espousing a dangerous ideology, but beneath it all was a consistency that hinted at something more. At promises kept, at a mutual and ancient devotion we might call, for lack of a better word, love. Richard Milhouse Nixon would never be loved like that. He'd always be incapable of eliciting the sincerity that Goldwater's supporters had expressed, due in no small part to the simple fact that he lacked this exact trait from the start. Then again, a politician of Nixon's emptiness, able to change his character to match whatever the electorate appeared to want, had a much better chance of appealing to a majority of Americans than a sincere extremist like Goldwater. Thompson knew this already, but to see it play out in person from only a few feet away was to be offered a glimpse into what it was that made a man like Richard Nixon so particularly evil, an innate and sinister talent for deception that the American electorate, when presented over and over again with its unabashed used car salesman tenor, somehow kept mistaking for an entirely different trait: ambition. In trust. A few weeks after the convention, Hunter Thompson was spending the evening at his small residence in Glen Ellen with Sandy and Juan and the Geiger family, who'd come by for dinner and drinks. Much later that night, with their wives and children asleep, Thompson and Geiger found themselves walking together along the dry, dark hillside. It was just past 4 a.m. First light was only an hour or so off, something they no doubt enjoyed waiting for, talking, as usual, about all that had recently happened. Geiger had meant to join Thompson at the Cow Palace for the Nixon-Goldwater speeches. But before the event, he'd been at an Italian restaurant in the city when the waiter said he had a phone call. It was his answering service. There'd been a terrible car crash in Sonoma, and he was needed in surgery immediately. Thompson had come away from the convention in a particular bind. Finally, he'd seen, up close, the first act in the drama he'd been sure was coming. But as a writer for The Observer, he'd never be able to express his perspective on it through a literary lens, as impressionistic journalism. Other writers like Joan Didion and Norman Mailer were experimenting formally, but Thompson lacked the fame and experience to land the high-paying, feature-length assignments that would allow the artistic leeway he was searching for. Mailer's stylistic approach served as a blueprint. Like Thompson, the famous fiction writer had also been there at the Cow Palace. On Thursday, he'd bribed a guard to get down on the floor for Goldwater's speech, and his subsequent essay for Esquire, In the Red Light, would encapsulate the sort of participatory experience Thompson wanted to convey. Mailer had exited the convention with the thousands of other attendees feeling the same despair that haunted Thompson. And so their sense of crisis opens, and they know, like me, that America has come to a point from which she will never return. The wars are coming, and the deep revolutions of the soul. That summer, Thompson began looking for a different employment venue, querying magazines like The New Republic and The Nation. He was also considering a move to San Francisco. He and Sandy and Juan would have less space and tranquility there, but he'd be able to react quickly to the Bay Area's fast-moving political and cultural developments. The day before the convention, 40,000 people had marched from the Embarcadero to the Civic Center, the largest civil rights protest in the city's history. At Berkeley, the free speech movement was taking off. The region itself was transitioning from its beat-centered counterculture to something new and more overt, something that seemed to be as much about personal expression as political act, and Thompson felt the need to be closer to it all. Bob Geiger had gone to medical school in the Haight-Ashbury district, one of the neighborhoods Thompson was considering, and it's fair to speculate that at some point during their pre-dawn walk along the Glen Ellen hillside a few weeks after the convention, the topic of moving to San Francisco would have naturally come up, though what happened next would, in retrospect, hasten the whole process. Just before sunrise, Thompson and Geiger noticed some gophers out beyond the shack. At first light, the small, surreptitious animals were perching at their holes. These gophers had been burrowing through the lawn at the front of the property, wrecking it, and Thompson and Geiger saw their appearance now as fortuitous. They went and got Thompson's shotgun. Together, they crept toward the lawn. Without hesitation, they fired volley after volley at their targets, which fled deep into the hill at the first deafening crack. Still, they kept shooting, taking turns. At that moment, it felt like a perfectly reasonable thing to do. Suddenly, they heard the shouts. The woman who owned the property was running at them. She